And now to some important international news. Normally at this time, we dig into the pages of the Washington Post Sunday magazine for interesting stories about the way we live now. But today we're going to turn to an extraordinary piece by Post foreign correspondent Craig Timberg that documents how the campaign of violence aimed at Zimbabwe's leading opposition party and its leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, was directed by officials at the highest levels of Zimbabwe's government, with the knowledge and participation of President Robert Mugabe. Mugabe was just sworn in for his sixth term as president last Sunday after a runoff election, which was boycotted by the opposition because of the violence. Craig Timberg is with us now by phone from Johannesburg. Thank you so much for joining us, Craig.
No, thanks for having me, Michelle.
Craig, the piece is extraordinary because it is based on notes that were actually taken at the meetings where the violence was planned. Is there anything you can tell us about how these notes were obtained?
Yeah, not a lot. I was working very closely with a Zimbabwean colleague, and while I am safe out of the country, you know, he and his family remain in some degree of peril, so probably the less said, the better. But the important thing is that we had notes and we had a number of direct firsthand accounts of people who were in the meetings when essentially the generals told President Mugabe that he was not going to lose anything, that he was going to stay in power and that they were going to take control and win this runoff election.
The piece says that Mugabe privately acknowledged defeat in the March election. In fact, the opposition has maintained all along that the opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change, did win, and many international observers agree with him. The piece says that Mugabe actually knew this, he acknowledged this, and was prepared to step down. Why didn't he?
He didn't because his top generals said no. I mean, Mugabe is, you know, is an 84-year-old man, and I think his, you know, his place in history in its way is kind of secure. But all of these people who are at the next level, in a sense, have a lot more to lose: their place in their power, their money, their place in society. And I think that they were not going to give up power merely because people voted against them.
What exactly is the relationship between Mugabe and the security forces? Your piece says that General Constantine Chiwenga says the choice was not Mugabe's alone to make. Is there some suggestion that Mr. Mugabe is perhaps afraid of his own security apparatus?
You know, for there's something called the Joint Operations Command in Zimbabwe, which is made up of the head of the military, the prison, the intelligence service, and the Air Force, and includes the president. And we've sort of long known dimly that that organization in its way really ran Zimbabwe, but it generally keeps a low profile except for when things get really hectic. And so it was when there was a possibility that the regime would lose power that suddenly this truly militarized organization stepped forward and asserted itself in a way that we hadn't seen in many years.
You're saying this plan of this planned attack on the opposition actually had a code name. Tell me what. What was the code name, and what did it involve?
The code name was CIBD, which stood for Coercion, Intimidation, Beating, and Displacement. And it's hard to imagine a better description of what happened in that country. They went out with lists, and they killed and tortured and beat and intimidated and coerced and drove people from their homes by the thousands upon thousands.
Do the notes that you were able to obtain show any disagreement with this?
Yeah, it was actually very interesting. The vice president, Joyce Majuro, who I'd never thought of as a particularly sentimental or soft-hearted character, did express some misgivings in some of these private meetings, as did at least one of the other quite senior generals, who suggested, first of all, that maybe the violence had gone too far, and also that it might backfire. But in the end, the hardliners prevailed.
Do you have any sense of, did the meeting suggest any sense of what they thought their end game would be? I mean, clearly the regime has shown that it is impervious to external criticism so far. But is there any acknowledgement of that, concern about that? I mean, do they think that the international community is just going to turn a blind eye, ignore it?
Yeah, the reporting for that story doesn't illuminate that question an awful lot. The moment in time where we had insight suddenly was in the first weeks, really, after they'd lost that initial runoff election, and their only priority seemed to be reestablishing their power. Now, the much bigger and more complicated question is, how do you keep power in a country where you have 9% inflation, as they now have, where your economy has utterly collapsed, where your skilled workers are going over the borders, and where you've been, isolated internationally? And I think that that's the really interesting question now. So Robert Mugabe and his ruling clique, they're now back in charge. But how do they make that place back into a country that anybody would want to be in charge of? And that's you know, that to me is a much more difficult question to answer.
The story indicates that it was based on the written notes of one participant, but that it was corroborated by other people with direct knowledge of the meeting. I don't know how you interpret this, but it suggests to me that someone wants the world to know that this occurred. Do you see any sign within the regime that there's a crack within the regime, that there is any sign of negotiation with the opposition, that there's any sign of acknowledgement of the international outcry that has ensued?
I would agree with you that it's clearly a divided regime, and it has been for some time. I mean, when one of the effects of having a single leader in power for 28 years is that everyone on the next level who imagines he or she might make a pretty good president at various points begins to agitate to kind of position themselves. And that's been going on for quite some time in Zimbabwe. And in fact, one of the reasons why they lost so badly back in the first round of voting in March is that it was a party divided unto itself. They do seem to have organized themselves better for the second round. They do seem a bit more unified, but I think there are very deep and fundamental cracks about how to move forward in that regime. There's also clearly a willingness to negotiate with the opposition. What's not at all clear is if there's a willingness to negotiate away power, as opposed to negotiate sort of specific things. You know, maybe they negotiate away the finance ministry, or they negotiate away a particular event. But I don't see these characters negotiating themselves out of power. I think that's the lesson we really get out of the last few months, is that they are willing to go essentially to any extent, use any means to keep the power in their own hands.
And as of course you know, that South Africa is playing a pivotal role. They're not only on Zimbabwe's border, but South African President Thabo Mbeki has sort of been tasked on behalf of the region with negotiating with the regime. He's been very heavily criticized for being too passive and for some would say enabling Mr. Mugabe and his actions in the campaign. What can you bring us up to date on what actions are occurring now? It's my understanding that Mr. Mbeki met with Mr. Mugabe over the weekend. Was there any result of these discussions that you can tell us?
Yeah, not really, because the opposition boycotted them. And so, look, here's the problem, that the opposition in Zimbabwe, Morgan Tsvangirai and others, are convinced that Thabo Mbeki, first of all, doesn't respect them, and that Mr. Mbeki has a kind of an affection and a supportiveness for President Mugabe that is entirely outsized. And in fact, I mean, they would portray Thabo Mbeki, the South African president, as the principal supporter and enabler of the Zimbabwean regime. So given that, whether or not that's true or fair, the fact that the opposition feels that way so strongly makes Mbeki not an ideal mediator. And so what's the sort of the subterranean thing that's going on right now is that the opposition is working very hard to get support around the region for having a broader sort of mediation team that probably includes Mbeki, but also includes some people who they perceive as either sort of fair dealers or potentially even their supporters. So what's going on now really sort of negotiations about negotiations.
And as you mentioned earlier, that there are just thousands upon thousands of Zimbabwean expatriates or refugees, if you will, taking refuge in South Africa because of both the economic and the political circumstances there. Is that having an effect on Mr. Mbeki's own standing at home, on his domestic political circumstance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spent, you know, 3 years, four years based in Johannesburg, and Mbeki's popularity has just plummeted over the past year. And among the most important reasons is that he's seen as bungling the Zimbabwe situation, and he's seen as not dealing effectively with an influx of Zimbabweans that's well into the millions. Its estimates go to 3 or 4 million. And just a couple of months ago, there were this incredible outbreak of vigilante violence in the townships where, you know, poor South Africans started, you know, beating and burning the homes and killing poor Zimbabweans who had fled there for refuge. And that really crystallized the frustration with Mugabe. And in fact, his party, you know, the African National Congress, the party of Thabo Mbeki and Nelson Mandela, has almost entirely abandoned Thabo Mbeki on this issue. He is really a man alone at this point in dealing gently with Robert Mugabe.
Craig Timberg is with the Washington Post Foreign Service. He joined us by phone from Johannesburg. If you want to read his piece in its entirety, we will have a link on our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Craig Timberg, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.